It is Saturday, July 18. We have a heavy day ahead, moving from the White House to the structural shifts in AI and global sports. Following up on yesterday's look at executive power, we are starting with the White House. President Trump gave a primetime address on election integrity. The speech did not offer new evidence of fraud in the 2020 election. Instead, it functioned as a command to federal officials to prioritize election investigations and lean on media organizations. This marks a pivot in executive strategy. The White House is moving away from trying to persuade the public with facts and toward the raw use of administrative power. Here's the thing. By framing the current electoral system as fundamentally broken, the administration is laying the groundwork for federal intervention in the 2026 midterms. We are talking about potential moves like the seizure of voting machines or ballots under the guise of emergency oversight. The guardrails that kept these impulses in check back in 2020 are largely gone. There is almost no internal dissent left in the current administration to act as a brake. This is also bleeding into the Senate confirmation process. Republican nominees, like Jay Clayton, pronounced Clayton, are being forced to play along with the denial narrative rather than simply affirming the results of the 2020 election. It's political theater, but it has real-world stakes. Even when these nominees struggle to get confirmed, they can often stay in critical roles indefinitely by serving in an acting capacity. It's a hell of a way to run a government. Meanwhile, the push for the SAVE Act, or the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act, is revealing a similar strategy. The bill is framed as a security measure, but it doesn't include funding for the actual infrastructure upgrades that experts say we need, like modernizing voting machines. It's an unfunded mandate. It creates administrative headaches for local clerks, all while keeping the idea of a broken system front and center. It's a pretext. If you keep telling people the system is rigged, you don't actually need to prove it when you lose. You just point to the narrative you've spent years building. Regarding Iran, the U.S. and its regional partners are currently managing a spike in drone-based attacks on shipping lanes in the Persian Gulf. The U.S. is relying on a strategy of economic sanctions and targeted strikes. This is an old playbook. Iran is now using mass-produced, cheap drones to neutralize American power in the region. The U.S. doesn't have an effective way to counter this zone control without risking a massive escalation. We are effectively choosing between a loss of influence or a level of conflict that carries massive economic risk. And because no American administration can afford the political cost of appearing to surrender or withdraw, we are stuck in a cycle of forever war. It's a strategic mismatch. Unless the U.S. shifts to a denial-based model, like building a legitimate counterbalancing coalition with Gulf states, we're just going to keep paying the costs without any clear path to a win. Back at home, the political discourse has shifted into a gear that is almost entirely performative. Both major parties are now prioritizing base maintenance over anything resembling actual governance. We are seeing this in the rise of the personal media brand politician. Take the critiques of J.D. Vance. His focus has shifted toward building a brand through podcasts and fringe rhetoric rather than the traditional, boring work of managing legislative relationships. When statecraft is replaced by content creation, the legislative process just grinds to a halt. This is being driven by the primary system. Candidates are forced to cater to the most intense, polarized subsets of their base just to get on the ballot. If you want to win a primary, you have to adopt extreme positions. That forces you to alienate the median voter, which makes winning a general election a volatile, uphill battle. It's a feedback loop that rewards spectacle over substance. And this isn't just happening in the abstract. It's bleeding into real-world violence. When you frame your political opponents as existential enemies who are out to destroy the country, you inevitably legitimize the use of force. Moderate officials are being forced into a defensive crouch, choosing between their policy goals and their own personal safety. It's a hell of a way to live, and it's effectively hollowing out the institution of government from the inside. We saw a clear example of this institutional failure in the recent Maine primary. The Graham Plattner campaign is a masterclass in how modern vetting is failing. Plattner was a viral candidate who managed to bridge the gap between progressive donors and rural working-class voters. He was an outsider who felt authentic, but it turned out the system had no way to catch the fact that he was effectively a fraud. Because the party establishment in Maine was so disconnected from the needs of their own voters, they left a vacuum. Plattner filled it with a narrative that felt real to people who felt ignored. When the campaign inevitably collapsed, it left the party fractured and scrambling to pick up the pieces. The lesson here is pretty ugly. If you don't provide a credible, vetted alternative to the status quo, you leave the door wide open for someone who can perform authenticity better than they can actually govern. Finally, there is a coordinated effort to weaponize harassment against the press. As a reminder of how this plays out, look at the eBay scandal. Executives there used a paramilitary-style security unit to terrorize journalists who asked questions about corporate spending. This wasn't a rogue operation. It was a management culture that decided harassment was a valid tool for conflict resolution. Reports indicate the leadership involved walked away with their wealth intact and landed on other corporate boards. That sends a signal to every other firm. If you want to suppress dissent, harassment works, and the consequences are basically non-existent. The end game here is a chilling effect. Whether it's the legal weight of a government subpoena or the trauma of being stalked by a corporate security team, the goal is to make the cost of reporting so high that it becomes unsustainable. We are trending toward a world where only the biggest, wealthiest institutions can afford the legal and psychological toll of holding people in power accountable. That leaves a massive vacuum where the state and corporate actors can operate without any fear of being questioned. Which, honestly, is the whole point. That kind of institutional capture isn't limited to government, though. It is bleeding into how we build our future tech. The release of the Kimi K3, pronounced Kimi K3, model from Moonshot AI, has shifted the competitive landscape for artificial intelligence. With 2.8 trillion parameters, the model has effectively closed the performance gap between open-weight alternatives and proprietary flagship systems. For years, the industry operated under the assumption that Western labs held a multi-month lead over international competitors. The Kimi K3 release challenges this. It demonstrates that Chinese labs have moved past simple distillation tactics into independent, large-scale pre-training. This shift forces a reality check for companies like OpenAI and Anthropic. If enterprise-grade performance is available through self-hosting, the value proposition of high-cost, closed ecosystem subscriptions drops significantly. Here is the thing, though. While K3 excels at UI-centric coding tasks, it still hits a wall in real-world engineering. It struggles with long-horizon reasoning and complex debugging. It is a capable prototype tool, but it is not yet a replacement for the reliability required in mission-critical enterprise environments. There is also a massive policy issue here. Because the model is unconstrained and open-weight, it lacks the guardrails baked into Western proprietary systems. This creates a potential security vacuum. If these models reach a point where they can be fine-tuned for cyber-offensive operations, the old strategy of locking down APIs is not going to work. Future security isn't about controlling access to the model. It is going to be about managing the consequences of its deployment. Beyond the Kimi K3 news, a separate shift is happening in how these models actually learn. Current AI is not sample efficient. It needs tens of thousands of data points to master tasks humans learn in a few tries. Researchers suggest this is because current systems lack a world model, an internal simulation of the environment that allows for predictive reasoning. Most current models, including large language models, use model-free learning. They map states to actions without actually understanding the environment. The next frontier is model-based learning, which functions more like a human neocortex by simulating the results of actions before they are taken. The goal is to move from simple pattern recognition to embodied intelligence. This brings us to a significant technical bottleneck. Techniques like Monte Carlo tree search require thousands of model invocations per action. That is great for planning, but it is too slow for real-time needs like autonomous driving or robotics. The industry is currently trying to figure out how to balance high-fidelity predictive planning with low-latency execution. We are also seeing a change in how professionals work with these systems. Experts are moving away from manual task execution toward agent orchestration. Features like Claude desktops, browser integration, and ChatGPT's unified history are pushing AI from passive assistants to active agents. But this introduces a coordination nightmare. Organizations now have to manage granular security permissions for every site these agents touch. They are forced to navigate the tension between the convenience of cross-platform syncing and the privacy risks of importing enterprise data into local environments. The takeaway across all of this is that the era of the isolated, all-knowing frontier model is ending. We are moving toward a fragmented, modular ecosystem. Developers are starting to build orchestration layers where a primary agent delegates high-complexity tasks to specialized subagents. This is a massive pivot for U.S.-based labs. While companies like Google reportedly delay releases to meet internal quality and safety standards, international competitors are prioritizing deployment velocity. If open weights models continue to match or exceed the performance of proprietary systems, the competitive advantage will shift away from those with the biggest raw models and toward those who can best integrate these tools into existing workflows. It is a hell of a thing to watch because it means the moat everyone was talking about a year ago, the idea that only a few companies could ever build these things, is rapidly drying up. Organizations that stay tied to a single proprietary stack are looking increasingly vulnerable to the speed of these open weights alternatives. Nobody is safe in their current market position, and frankly, that is probably for the best. But while we obsess over the digital future, we are still struggling to manage the physical realities of the present. The horse racing industry is currently struggling with a series of operational bottlenecks. Canadian wildfires have forced the cancellation of racing days at tracks including Woodbine, Colonial Downs, and Delaware Park. These closures highlight a lack of industry-wide strategies to handle environmental volatility. Infrastructure failures are also causing significant disruptions. Ruidoso Downs, pronounced R-W-I-D-O-H-S-O, was recently forced to close due to a damaged culvert, which effectively paralyzed the entire facility. This serves as a reminder that a single point of failure in civil engineering can render a track and its associated casinos completely inoperable. Beyond the physical track, the way races are structured is creating its own set of problems. Many tracks are using purse-doubling incentives to attract Grade 1 winners. Analysts point out that this creates a winner-take-all dynamic in races like the Mr. Prospector Stakes at Monmouth Park. While it brings in high-tier horses like Book M. Dano, it ends up discouraging other entrants. This shrinks field sizes and ultimately hurts the wagering ecosystem by reducing betting depth. There is also a persistent gap in how data is applied to the sport. Performance metrics like speed figures are often non-transferable between circuits because track geometry and turf layouts vary so wildly. Bettors at places like Kentucky Downs frequently find their traditional data irrelevant when applied to other venues. This makes it difficult to rely on past performance alone. The shift toward digital platforms is changing how the game is actually played. It is no longer necessary to be on-site to participate in high-level wagering, as shown by the LRF Cares charity challenge at Del Mar. Players can now use sites like horseplayers.com to compete for national horse handicapping championship spots from anywhere. Strategically, the current consensus among analysts like PTF and Nick Tamaro is to look for horses that are mispriced due to class drops or changes in training. For instance, in the Grade 2 San Diego, journalism is being highlighted as a strong favorite not because of his recent finishes, but because he is dropping in class. This creates a market inefficiency where the public might overlook a horse's true ability. The same logic applies to managing multi-race bets like the Pick 6 or the Haskell Day Late Pick 5. Experts suggest that the biggest mistake is watering down tickets with marginal horses just to stay alive. A more effective approach involves identifying anchor horses and maintaining a lean, high-confidence ticket. Betting against favorites like Napoleon Solo in the Haskell is presented as a rational move, specifically because his reputation is tied to a speed-biased track rather than raw talent. Ultimately, the industry is moving away from simple intuition and toward a model of active, data-driven analysis. Success now requires understanding that trainers, like those managing young stock for Schultz or Disruiso, pronounced Dayarwiso, are essentially portfolio managers. They are balancing the physiological needs of individual animals against the financial reality of needing to win races to stay solvent. It is a messy, fragile business, and the people winning are the ones who stop looking at the surface-level noise and start spotting the structural gaps that everyone else is ignoring. That fragility isn't just a problem for the track. It is becoming the standard operating procedure for the biggest events on Earth. The 2026 FIFA World Cup is currently in the planning stages for host nations, and the industry focus is on commercial scale. FIFA has confirmed that they are prioritizing global entertainment spectacles over traditional football norms. The tournament's most significant legacy in development is the normalization of revenue-generating tactical interruptions. Hydration breaks, which were initially controversial, are being viewed as valuable commercial inventory. FIFA now views these pauses as potential revenue drivers, and it is likely we will see them become a permanent feature of global competition, including upcoming tournaments in Spain and Morocco. This shift toward high-frequency, infrastructure-dependent events is reshaping where these tournaments can even be held. Because FIFA is pushing to expand to 48 teams, with internal talk of reaching 64, future tournaments will almost exclusively favor markets with existing premium infrastructure. Simply put, there are only a handful of global markets that can handle the sheer logistical scale and corporate hospitality demands of a tournament this size. Meanwhile, in Major League Soccer, teams are aggressively trying to capitalize on this momentum. MLS clubs are using the World Cup as a marketing tool to shed the league's retirement league reputation. They are moving toward a localized sampling model, pouring millions into high-production watch parties and international training facilities. They are betting that if they can show off world-class infrastructure to elite international players, they can create a feedback loop of talent acquisition. It is a bold, albeit risky, infrastructure-heavy play to turn temporary World Cup interest into a permanent reputation for competitive excellence. Back on the domestic collegiate and professional front, the trend toward aggressive, short-term revenue growth continues to accelerate. Texas Tech recently signed a 15-year, $75 million deal to rename its stadium after the brand Galaxy. We are seeing major athletic departments treat their physical assets as liquid inventory, trading away institutional heritage for immediate capital. We are also seeing the consequences of chasing digital native audiences. When sports move to streaming, the trade-off is often immediate. The Home Run Derby, for example, reportedly saw a 7% year-over-year ratings drop after moving to Netflix. While leagues may gain long-term relevance on new platforms, they are currently losing the broad, habitual reach that traditional broadcast television provided. Finally, even the elite franchises are changing how they finance their operations. The New York Yankees recently secured $3 billion in financing from the private equity firm Apollo. This is a shift in how we should view these teams. Elite franchises no longer see private equity as a last resort for stadium construction. Instead, they are using it as a standard financial tool to manage debt and optimize capital. The era of the traditional sports franchise, largely insulated from the mechanics of corporate finance, is effectively over. It is all about scale now. And when the dust settles on these massive spectacles, you find the same legal maneuvering used to keep the cameras off the real story. Investigative documentary filmmaking is hitting a wall. A new analysis suggests that powerful figures are using the legal system to silence criticism and kill projects before they even reach an audience. The strategy here is simple. Plaintiffs file nuisance lawsuits against filmmakers. Even when those lawsuits lack merit, the legal costs and the potential for a long, drawn-out battle force distributors and insurers to back down. When major players like Disney or CBS choose to settle these cases, they send a clear message to the market. Weaponized litigation works. This creates a vicious cycle. As insurance costs climb, distributors are leaning into safer content like true crime or celebrity profiles, which, honestly, is a hell of a lot easier to market than hard-hitting investigative work. That leaves the public with less scrutiny of the people who actually run the world. The problem is that, for a billionaire or a massive corporation, a settlement is just a line item. If the cost of paying off a critic is lower than the reputational damage caused by a documentary, litigation just becomes a standard business expense. We do have anti-SLAPP, pronounced SLAPP, statutes in some places, which allow defendants to recover attorney fees for frivolous lawsuits. But those laws vary wildly by state and aren't moving at the federal level. Until distributors stop treating First Amendment defense as a liability and start treating it as an operational necessity, the barrier to entry for investigative work is only going to get higher. Moving over to the markets, things are looking pretty twitchy for growth stocks. Investors are currently allergic to anything that smells like operational friction. SpaceX is not a publicly traded company, but secondary market valuations have seen pressure following a Starship launch abort caused by engine performance issues. Investors are currently punishing the company for technical delays, prioritizing immediate execution over long-term development. The need to replace two Raptor engines for the Starship V3 program has affected sentiment in private trading circles. Netflix is dealing with a different kind of friction. The company reported 13.4% year-over-year revenue growth and $4.19 billion in operating income, but the stock is down because they missed revenue projections by $20 million. The real kicker is the free cash flow, which came in at $1.53 billion against expectations of $2.93 billion. Investors don't seem to care about subscriber growth anymore. They want to see cash, and they want to see it now. Wayfair is trying to clear its own hurdle. They are planning a massive summer sale to compete with Black Friday, intentionally avoiding a direct collision with Amazon Prime Day. The stock is down 2.7% in pre-market trading, and all eyes are on their August 4th earnings report. If these discounts don't move the needle, it will pretty much confirm that consumer demand is cratering. Look, the market is currently in a mood. Companies like Star Surgical, which dropped 12% despite doubling its revenue, prove that strong growth isn't enough to save you right now. Investors are in full risk mitigation mode. If you miss your numbers, you get hit. It doesn't matter how good the story is or how much you grew. If there is even a hint of uncertainty, the market is going to take its cut. It is a lot to carry, and it is easy to see why we are all feeling a bit frayed at the edges. We are currently seeing a confluence of reporting on the psychological costs of modern life. Recent analysis suggests that the pursuit of professional and material success often masks a deeper crisis of meaning. Even when people reach major milestones, they frequently face a void because they traded their moral or spiritual foundations for individual autonomy. Rainn Wilson, pronounced Rainn Wilson, argues that this dissatisfaction is not a failure of achievement, but a failure of inquiry. He suggests that unless you actively choose a framework for your existence, whether it is grounded in a creative force or a purely biological one, you remain stuck in existential uncertainty. The process of asking these questions, rather than arriving at a final answer, appears to be the only way to turn private anxiety into public purpose. This tracks with broader warnings about our current trajectory. As artificial intelligence automates labor and secures basic survival, we risk removing the very hardships that our brains evolved to overcome. Without the necessity of work and struggle, we may face the same behavioral breakdown documented in the Universe 25 mouse experiment. That is a hell of a thing to consider while we race toward a future of total automation. The takeaway from these reports is that meaning in an age of abundance will not be provided by your environment. It has to be built. If you don't voluntarily construct a hard mode for your life, through skill acquisition, service to others, and deliberate intellectual engagement, you are essentially setting yourself up for the same social and psychological disintegration that happens when an organism loses its purpose. Look, it is easy to get distracted by the curated performance of others on social media, but if you are not calculating the future cost of your current choices, you are just running on a treadmill. Stop treating money as an identity and start using it as a tool. Anyway, before you head out to enjoy the rest of your weekend, here is what else is moving the needle. A few other things worth knowing today. Don Cornelius pioneered a media model where he owned the show instead of the network. This gave him total creative control and kept the program an authentic celebration of Black culture, which is a hell of a lot more than you can say for most corporate-backed projects. Collective action is apparently the best cure for cynicism. It turns individual frustration into a shared political identity by letting people tell their own stories, which sounds like a much better use of time than doom-scrolling. The Roman Republic didn't just vanish overnight. It collapsed because the basic deal between citizens, property, and politics stopped working under the weight of economic pressure, proving that institutions are only as strong as their weakest social contract. If you are looking for a roadmap to survive a total system collapse, maybe go back and read The Odyssey. It suggests that rebuilding order requires a mix of clever strategy and the occasional willingness to use force, which is a fairly grim takeaway for your morning commute. That is the state of things this morning. Keep your eyes open, stay skeptical, and I will see you back here tomorrow.